First of all, I want to thank the organizers for this interesting conference and giving me the opportunity to tell you a little bit about what we've been doing. My background is in condensed matter physics, so I'm not an expert on the details of earthquakes. We have mostly been studying magnets, and then by talking with Yehuda Ben Zion and other geophysicists, we're seeing some connections to earthquakes. And so what I thought what I'm going to do is tell you sort of the background in magnets, because I know it's a very diverse audience, and then show you the connections to the background in magnets and show you the connections to earthquakes. And particularly, our goal is to test models. So that was originally the goal in the context of magnets, and I think there's some tools that then can be applied to test earthquake models as well. Now the work that I'm going to talk about, a lot of it has been done with my students at Urbana, in particular Amit Mehta, who's now at MIT, and then in collaboration with Yehuda Ben Zion, the part on the earthquakes, which started originally also with Daniel Fisher. And the magnet part started with Jim Sethna, but most of it that I'm going to talk about has been done at Urbana. All right, you all know about systems that are hysteretic. We were originally interested in hysteresis in magnetic systems. So basically, when you take something and you bend it out of shape, it doesn't snap back, so it remember you did something to it. Those are the types of hysteretic systems we're looking at. But in particular, those systems where when you apply a slowly changing driving force, they respond in a jerky fashion. So not as smooth as this copper rod where you don't hear anything crackle. We're interested in systems where when you apply a slow driving force, they have a jerky response. Then we call this jerky response crackling noise. In the context of magnets, that's measured as Barkhausen noise. So in magnetic systems, what you do is you wrap a surge coil around it, and then you apply a slowly increasing magnetic field, and basically you magnetize the system, and this magnetization process happens in jumps. So you get avalanches of domains that flip in the direction of the field, and that they give you in voltage pulses by induction. And so when you plot these voltage pulses as a function of time, as you slowly increase the field, you get a pattern that looks like this. Now, if you're thinking about earthquakes, let me just say this right from the start. An avalanche of spin flips is very similar to an earthquake if you think of an earthquake as a sudden rupture event. So you have patches that are along the fault that rupture. And then the analogous quantity that would be analogous to the voltage, the induced voltage in this Barkhausen noise experiment, would be the moment rate in earthquakes. And so the integral over the voltage over time, so the area under these pulses, tells you how many spins flipped in an avalanche in the magnets, and that would be the total moment of the earthquake. So there are a lot of systems that have crackling noise in response to a slowly changing driving force. I talked about magnets. So the noise sounds something like this. That was basically feeding this voltage signal into a loudspeaker. And that's how originally people discovered that the magnetization process is very jerky. They just hooked it up to a loudspeaker and heard this noise. Now, there are other systems that have crackling noise. For example, martensites, so these shaped memory alloys, when you pull on them, they crackle. Superconductors, you can have avalanches of vortices when you increase the applied magnetic field. Or there are these very nice experiments on liquid helium invading nuclear pore that's a porous material, and the fluid invades in a jerky fashion. And Mark Robbins has done some very nice theoretical work on that, and there are these experiments by Bob Halleck and them studying actually experiments today. You all know this effect when you have your Rice Krispies in the morning and you pour milk over them. Then it crackles, and then it sounds something like this. All right, so this is crackling noise also. All I want to say is these are systems where you have a very irregular response to a smoothly varying driving force. Rupture of fibrous materials is another example, or earthquakes. So, for example, here is a sequence of earthquakes over a year, and their magnitudes are plotted on the y-axis, and you see you get different sizes of earthquakes also. And so that's another example of crackling noise, if you like. Now, what all these systems have in common is if you plot a distribution of the Earth, of the event sizes in these different systems as a function of their size, basically a histogram, you get a very broad range of sizes, which follows a power law over several decades. The interesting thing in the context of magnets is that this power law is universal. That means there are lots of different magnetic materials that have exact same power law exponent here. And so the question is, why is there power law scaling, and can we understand this better? And now, I really don't want to get too much into magnets, but let me just, because it highlights the main idea, which I think is more general, let me just very quickly go over this this simple magnet model that, and then emphasize the main point we wanted to make with this. So for the magnets, we started with the zero temperature non-equilibrium random field Ising model, which is basically saying, oh, in a magnet, I have a we're focusing on universal properties like these exponents, which apparently don't depend on the microscopic details because they're the same for many different materials. So it should be all right to come up with a very simple model that only gets symmetries, dimensions, a few other things right to predict these universal aspects on long length scales. So we use this this Ising model, so you have spins that can only point up or down. They're ferromagnetically coupled, so you have a regular lattice of spins ignoring all the microscopic details. And then we say the spins like to point in the same direction. Then we say we have disorder in the system, and that will play a role when we come to the earthquakes in a moment. And we take, in this case, we say the disorder is modeled by random magnetic fields. So we're saying there is a frozen in magnetic field, these green arrows are supposed to indicate that, that's taken from a Gaussian distribution of random fields. The width of that is R, that's supposed to be the strength of the disorder. And then we study the system originally at zero temperature, ignoring all thermal fluctuations, but by now we also have a pretty good idea what temperature does, but let's ignore that right now. And so let's study it far from equilibrium, because we study hysteresis, like in magnetic tapes, they're not designed to equilibrate at room temperature. And then we say the simplest dynamics we assume for this is there is a local force or a local field. As we slowly raise the field, we say each spin flips when the local field, which is the sum of the external field, the random field, and the interaction with the neighbors, goes from down to up, right? That's the simplest assumption you can make. So that's a lot like in an earthquake model where you have a threshold to slipping for a patch on the fault. So when your local force goes from down to up, the spin flips. That's the assumption. So then we started a very negative field. All the spins are pointing down, and then we slowly raise the field. That would be like in an earthquake, you have tectonic loading, very slow loading from far away. And then we slowly raise the field, and when one spin decides to flip, like one with a very large random field, for example, like this one, decides to flip, then because of the ferromagnetic interaction with the neighbors, it can trigger other spins also to flip. So you get an avalanche of spin flips. And these you can see these as jumps in the magnetization curve. And they are the analog of Barkhausen noise that is measured in real materials. Now, so when you simulate that, then you find, indeed, you get a hysteresis as you go drive the field up and back down again. So zero temperature, because equilibration time scale is large compared to experimental time scale. Now, we were asking what happens as we change the disorder in the system. So here you see this is the distribution of random fields. If the distribution of random fields is very narrow, so this quantity R, which is the width of this, is very small, then it turns out as you slowly raise the field, you get an avalanche that sweeps through the entire system because there's no disorder to stop it. So your hysteresis loop is very square because this big jump here in your magnetization is this one big avalanche that sweeps through the system. On the other hand, if your system has a... Okay, let me just do this. As you increase the disorder, you make that distribution more broad. If you get to a very broad distribution of random fields, you get a very smooth hysteresis curve. That means your jumps are very small. You've lost this big jump that you have for a very clean system. And in between these two regimes, between clean and highly disordered, there turns out to be a critical disorder where you get jumps of all sizes. So you see you have large ones, but you know, you also have small ones down here, and so you get jumps of all sizes. So you can actually draw a phase diagram. This is a second order phase transition as a function of disorder. At low disorder, and this axis is disorder, on this axis is a magnetic field that you apply. So as you ramp up the field as low disorder, you eventually have this big jump here. While if you ramp it up at high disorder, you have no such jump. And in between these two regimes, at a critical disorder, that's where your phase transition point is, where you get jumps of all sizes. Now, here is a distribution of these avalanche sizes for different disorder. Remember, R was the width of that Gaussian distribution there. So for very high disorder, the critical disorder is 2.16. It's non-universal, the critical disorders, but in this model it's 2.16. So as you are at higher disorder, you see you have mostly small jumps in your distribution of avalanche sizes. This is again the histogram on a log-log plot. But as you go to lower disorders and approaching the critical disorder, that distribution approaches a power law, just like you would expect near a phase transition point. So then you can basically rescale these axes in such a way that all these curves collapse onto one and you get this function here. This is basically this plot here with rescaled axes. And from the amount by which you rescale these axes, you can read off these universal exponents that are the same for lots of different materials. So these are predictions from the model. And actually this entire function here is also a prediction from the model that if you would do something like this, do measurement at different disorders and do the same collapse, you should, if the theory works, you should get the same same function even. Yep? Yeah, this is a non-equilibrium phase diagram. So we are, forget everything you know about equilibrium physics. This is a non-equilibrium phase diagram. So this is a non-equilibrium phase transition. Actually, that's very important because everywhere here you are far from equilibrium because you have hysteresis at all the different disorders. But it's still a phase transition in the sense that you have a diverging correlation length at this point. That means, you know, at high disorders, you have a maximum avalanche size that's given, the diameter is given by the correlation length. But that correlation length diverges as you approach this critical point. So basically, just like in the equilibrium systems, near this phase transition point, you have universal behavior in the sense of scaling and so on, but you're not in an equilibrium state. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yep. This one is a nearest neighbor, and I'll come to that. For the earthquakes, actually, we have taken into account the full long-range aspect. All right. Now, okay. Why? Now, if you are familiar with equilibrium phase transitions, then you know that equilibrium phase transitions, yeah, they're interesting because it's universal. But the range where you see this universal behavior usually is tiny. If you go 2% away from the critical point, you lose effect. This is different here. Here, if you go 50% away from the critical point, you still have 2 decades of scaling. So it means we have this enormously large range around this critical point where you would see the scaling. And that's why this is useful for experiments, because your systems might just fall into this very large region around the critical point. Okay, then there's a lot more you can do, and for lack of time, I'll just flash this up. If you have such a noise train, then you can study power spectra as a function of disorder and do scaling collapses. And then Amit Mehta has done a very careful study of second spectra in mean field theory and simulations and experiment that seems to work very well, that tells you about correlations in power spectra. So there's a lot more you can do and a lot more universal information you can extract from this model to compare with experiments. Now why is this interesting in this context? If you really want to understand why is there power law scaling, you really need to do a randomization group study of the system. The randomization group was originally developed for equilibrium phase transitions, but you can actually modify and apply to non-equilibrium systems too. The main idea here is that the randomization group is a method to look at your system from further and further away. It's a transformation to look at the system, basically step back and you look at it from further and further away. Now, systems at phase transition points where they have power law scaling look the same on different scales. Right? So systems at phase transition points should be fixed points under this coarse-graining transformation, because they look the same no matter on which scale you look at them. Which here is a plot of the avalanches of the magnet model, and you see on the scale here, this is 100 cube spin, and this is a 1,000 cube spin simulation. The different colors are different avalanches that you see as you raise the field. And you see statistically, this is rescale, statistically, they look the same. So this is at the critical point where your system looks the same on different scales. So you can use this randomization group to look for fixed points, which are phase transition points, and you linearize a fixed point, and that allows you to analytically calculate these universal critical exponents. And we've done that for this system. But I think what's much more interesting, or why this is so useful, is because it allows you to determine how large the universality class of this model is. So for example, if you apply that to the system, you find if you use random couplings instead of random fields, or if you use a different distribution of random fields, like a parabola instead of a Gaussian or something, or if you use random anisotropies, or lots of other changes that you make to this model, they all lead to the exact same critical exponent. So you can show that. So you can analytically show which class of models all give you the same predictions for the behavior on long length scales. Yep? That's correct. The mean stays positive. That's correct. Yep. And then you can ask, what about other universality classes? So if you add long-range forces, for example, if you add dipolar forces, that changes things. Or, for example, you can change the dynamics to only having spins flip at the interface, like Mark Robbins and others have done. And that also changes the exponents. What we found is, so first of all, you can, from a randomization group, you can calculate all these different critical exponents, and it turns out in six dimensions and higher, you can do it analytically, and then if we live in three dimensions, so you have to extrapolate down to three dimensions, you can analytically expand around six dimensions. So the dashed curves here are the exponents as a function of dimension extrapolated down from six dimensions analytically. And then the points with the arrow bars are simulations in the corresponding dimensions, and you see that works down to three dimensions real well. But what I really wanted to focus on is this down here. This is comparison with experiments. So we want to know how well does this model actually do compared to experiments. Now the red dots here are the results for different exponents, some from the power spectra, some from the size distribution. And the blue symbols are from experiments that were quoted in the literature. There so far still is no experiment that I'm aware of that has measured the noise for different disorders in a controlled way, but there's some experiments that saw something like that in the hysteresis loop by Andreas Berger, but we really need noise experiments. But what was quoted in the literature was where people just had taken a sample without changing the disorder and measured some exponents, and so we're falling pretty well within the range of experiments quoted in the literature. So at first we were excited about this, but then we looked closer and we saw there were other models, like the mean field model, for example, that is the model where you have infinite range interactions that does just as well compared to the experiments if you just look at exponents. Or the front propagation model, where you just have a single front propagating, also falls within the range. So the exponents are not enough to determine which is the right model. Well, this is just from, just quoted from the... Okay, all right. Actually, there are two classes of experiments here. Some that are definitely front propagation experiments, because we know from other experiments that for this system, it's a single front propagating. So we know for some of these experiments in here that they should be in the front propagation universality class. Right. So this is all the Barkhausen noise experiments. But there are a lot of experiments where we have no clue which regime they're in. And the thing is, the arrow bars of the experiments of the front propagation and the other ones, they are overlapping anyway. So basically, this is just the range as quoted in the literature for Barkhausen noise experiments. They're all the same type of experiments, different materials. Yeah. And some of them didn't even have arrow bars, so we don't know for all of them. Oh my goodness. All right. All right. So this is, now I'm actually coming to the main point. So we said obviously exponents are not enough. So, but we saw earlier there are actually entire functions that are universal that you can determine. So So the problem was there was no experiments for noise at different disorders that could allow us to actually calculate that one function from the collapse for different disorders that I showed you earlier. That function has not yet been measured as far as I know. But there's one function, or actually a couple functions, that you actually can measure by only using one sample. And this function is interesting for the earthquakes. That's why I'm going over this. If you plot the voltage as a function of time for a single avalanche, it's a very noisy function. But if you now average over all functions with the same duration, you get a mean profile for your avalanches. This is now in a system that has parallel distribution of avalanche sizes. If you now do the same thing for avalanches of a longer duration, you get a profile for the longer avalanches. Then you can rescale the axes and collapse those functions onto one, and you get this universal scaling function that we calculated, which looks something like this in the model. So it looks like pretty much like a parabola. In mean field theory, actually, it is a parabola. Then we went to the experimentalists, and we asked them to measure the same thing, and this is what they found. It's an asymmetric function. While in the theory it's very symmetric, here it's clearly asymmetric. So while the exponents fall well within the range of the experiments, the function doesn't. So for a long time we were wondering what's going on. Recently, actually just this spring, Gianfranco Durin and the Italian group, they came up with a suggestion that the reason for the magnets could be eddy currents. So the eddy currents acting like an additional damping, which is actually like a negative mass term for the domain wall, which introduce a microscopic timescale in the system. And that microscopic timescale is long enough to show up as an asymmetry in the scaling function for the short avalanches that they measured in the experiment. If they had taken much longer avalanches, that asymmetry would disappear. And in fact, they show that with size, that asymmetry gets less and less for longer and longer avalanches. So this asymmetry is not universal. It should disappear on long length scales. Now, okay, so the main point was now to make the switch to the earthquake. So I talked about, there's a lot more you can do on magnets that I won't talk about. But so I talked about how you'd see a transition from having statistics of a large event that spans the system for very clean systems to power law as you increase the disorder in the system. And then even beyond that to small events at high disorder. And when I once gave a talk on that, Yehuda Ben Zion said, that looks just like earthquakes. And he showed me this data. It turns out, you all know about the Gutenberg-Richter law, where you have power law scaling globally. But if you do statistics for individual fault zones, you find that some fault zones have Gutenberg-Richter scaling for the event size distribution, so frequency size distribution, while others, like the San Andreas fault, have these quasi-periodically recurring large events, which gives you this characteristic earthquake distribution. So it turns out that those faults that give you this behavior tend to be faults that have a lot of offsets, that geometrically much more disordered than these that are the older faults that are more smoothed out. So very much analogous to the magnets, disorder in the fault is reflected in the statistics of earthquake sizes. So then, since I'm running out of time, I think I'll spare you the details on this model. We used this model developed by Yehuda and Jim Rice, where they basically project a three-dimensional fault zone onto a two-dimensional fault plane, and then take these offsets into account as disorder in the brittle structure, in the brittle patches. And then these earthquakes are really much like avalanches of slips of these patches as you load the fault from far away, so you have creep on the boundaries. And then you find as a phase diagram, you get that this model in the quasi-static limit gives you power law, but then if you introduce something like a threshold weakening, which is a lot like static versus dynamic friction, you get a characteristic earthquake distribution. You get these large events. The large events scale crack-like, the events out here, while the events in the power law tail scale the moment scales like the area. And you can actually solve a lot of things analytically here, because it turns out the normalization group tells you that the long-range elastic interactions that you get along the fault are long enough that mean field theory gives you exact results in the physical dimension. And then you can actually extend this phase diagram by introducing some global strengthening. I won't have time to go into that. That would correspond to the high disorder regime in the magnets. What I really wanted to really quickly flesh up is the same question that we asked about the function. turns out if you compare exponents in for earthquakes, the error bars for exponents are very, very large. So basically, just comparing models to the data by just looking at exponents is not sufficient in many cases. So it would be very nice to have an entire function again that you can compare to the earthquakes. So we just learned from the magnets that the scaling function of the voltage is a universal scaling function. So in the same way, in this case, we could calculate the analogous function. So you could say, let me take earthquakes of a given duration and average over all those earthquakes of the same duration. That gives me a mean profile for that earthquake. And then let me do that for a longer duration and average over lots of them. And we've done that here for different durations. And then we've rescaled those profiles, trying to find this universal scaling function that's analogous thing to the magnets. And this the black line here is the prediction from the model, which actually also for the earthquake model is a parabola. And these are the data. Now, you see the error bars are very large, so we cannot say anything definite. But it looks like you have an asymmetry here for the earthquakes as well. And and there's another function where you can do the same thing instead of given duration, given moment, and there you can calculate prediction for that. And that seems to work out in the tails. But really what we need is more data for small earthquakes to accurately determine this function from the data. Now you might ask, this asymmetry is the same, sort of in the same direction as in the magnets. In the magnets it was due to sort of an extra damping from the eddy currents. So you might ask, is there maybe a similar strengthening process in the earthquakes that's responsible for this asymmetry or not? Or is it strong asperities? We don't know. And especially as long as we don't have better data, we don't know for sure. So at this point, I better stop. So basically, I've just tried to show some analogies between magnets and earthquakes. And the nice thing about the magnets is you can just do a lot of experiments and get good statistics. But we would like to see similar things done for earthquakes. Thank you very much.
Slide.
Yes.
Maybe the error bars are too large, but it seems that the asymmetry works the opposite way as for the magnets, no?
I think so too. In fact, if you don't care about the in this case with the error bars, actually there is an asymmetry. The thing is, though, the error bars is statistically formally not significant, speaking. But if you would average over, instead of trying to make a collapse, but just average over all these earthquakes, then you can get a much smoother curve, and it clearly, yeah, I think it has an asymmetry.
Another question is, is your theory able to say something about the transition between the seismic moment rate during the main shock and the smooth transition, which is now seen more and more smoother to the aftershock sequence?
Okay.
And especially the fact that you are, putting to zero the seismic moment rate after the end of the earthquake, but which is, of course, a cartoon, because aftershocks, we know now, are already starting in some of the places, maybe even at position where the fault has stopped. And so what is your theory able to do with this respect?
All right. Okay. We have, what we've done is we have sort of a cartoon version for aftershocks. You could, if you wanted to introduce aftershocks into this model, you could say, and I'm not saying this is a realistic model, it's just an attempt to get, actually the way this was motivated originally was we wanted to see, what was the analogous phase on the other side to the magnets. But if you would say, I introduce a threshold strengthening, threshold weakening gives you these large runaway events. But if you say, aftershocks happen away from the main fault, and typically, and you say you have a threshold strengthening because often you have an aftershock happening here, and then instead of that one growing, you have another event happening over here. If you would introduce something like a threshold strengthening that then slowly decays with time as a healing process, you could introduce aftershocks into this model as well. But I'm not claiming that this is a realistic aftershock model. It's just a cartoon version of what might be the process. But that wouldn't play into these moment rates. The moment rates are really single events you know, basically the how much slip you have per time for one event. And as long as this weakening is not very fast, you don't have, basically, if you get aftershocks overlapping with main shocks, depend how quickly you weaken the strengthening in this model. If you make that very slow, then you can very well separate a main shock and an aftershock. If you tune that parameter, it's as if you were driving your system in with a faster rate. And of course, then you can have an aftershock starting before the main one ends. But that, you know, in this model, it is up to you. Yes, I agree.
And then the question is how can you transfer to the crossover to the regular aftershock?
Yes, okay, all right. So that's a good point. You could if you have this strengthening, and actually that was sort of what we had in mind when we learned about the eddy currents. In the eddy currents, you have a short-term strengthening that time scale is short compared to the avalanche duration. But if you have a strengthening in the earthquakes, that would die down with a time scale long compared to the typical earthquake duration, then that would give you a net asymmetry that would show up in the form of main shock, aftershock, aftershock, aftershock. So you're right. You could interpret that also as sort of an asymmetry on a larger scale. But if that's the mechanism, you know.
Going back just to the magnets,
yeah.
Simple system. Are the clusters associated with the avalanche just fractal, or is there surface self-affine?
Okay, so the fractal dimension of in the magnets is basically in three dimensions. It's three. So they're compact avalanches, but you see they look very. Yes. Okay. Yes. At the critical point.
At the critical point, they're fractal.
In three dimensions, the fractal dimension is three. So it's basically numerically indistinguishable from three. Let me say that. You know, from the arrow bars that we have. In four dimensions, if you would go to four dimensions, they would be fractal. So basically, in three dimensions, we cannot tell. It's maybe 2.99999. We can't tell the difference. But from numerically, but basically, they look compact. Although they're irregular. I mean, yes. When you go towards supercoalition.
No, but at the critical disorder.
At the critical disorder, they're compact. Yes.
They're compact. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
I mean, as far as we can tell.
I was hoping you could use their fractal nature to predict the shape of this universal function.
This universal function, we get that's a function that doesn't depend on whether they're fractal or not. You can determine that in each dimension. You can determine that in four dimensions whether fractal, or you know, in three dimensions or in three dimensions. In all these dimensions, it looks very much like mean field theory, which is a parabola, a slight deviation.